It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we get an inside tour of a Racine Tower designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, just opened up to the public.
First, the Federal Communication Commission today approved a plan which will allow broadband providers to charge websites a priority rate for faster internet service. The proposal would essentially create two streams of internet service, a fast lane offered at a premium rate, and everything else.
Observers say this could dramatically reshape the way users surf and experience the internet. It could open the door to internet service providers charging websites for higher quality delivery of their content to consumers.
So what does this mean for internet users and website content providers? Huffington Post reporter Matt Sledge has been covering the issue. He joins us now. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me on.
So Matt, you've been following and reporting on this net neutrality issue and today's FCC announcement. Tell us a little bit about what it says.
So we actually don't know what it says yet because the FCC is a little bit secretive, and when they vote on what they something like they voted today, it takes them a little while to actually put out the text of it. Technically, it's called a notice for proposed rulemaking. But what we do know from public comments that the commissioners have made is basically that the FCC's chairman, Tom Wheeler, is envisioning this kind of early-stage plan that might let your internet service provider, your broadband company, charge websites like Netflix for quick access for ordinary folks. It's important to keep in mind that this is just kind of the vote today just kind of kicked off the discussion. People have 120 days to comment.
And so essentially what the headline is then is that there could be a fast lane of the internet if content providers want to pay a little bit more, and then for maybe smaller companies, I guess, or other people who don't want to pay more, slower service.
Yeah, that could happen. It won't happen tomorrow, but eventually we could see an internet where maybe you and I as customers have to pay more for quicker internet, or maybe companies like Netflix have to pay more to get their content to us, but it would mark a rather dramatic shift from the way things have generally worked until now, where everybody has basically equal access on all sides.
So what is driving this change right now?
I think the big thing that's driving it is changes in the industry itself. We are using websites like Netflix that pump out a lot of traffic, these big video sites. So whereas in the past, if we were all just sending emails, it wasn't as big a deal. We weren't using up as much of the pipe, but we're kind of coming up toward the limit of what the pipes that the internet runs over can deliver to us. So the big question is, if we want to upgrade those pipes, who's going to pay? Is it going to be the broadband companies? Is it going to be companies like Netflix? Is it going to be you or me?
And these proposals, they come after the latest volley of talks and criticism and all of that between internet providers, content providers, and consumers. Can you frame a little bit of the debate for us about, you know, who's angling for which sort of a scenario to unfold here?
Sure. These big broadband companies like Verizon and AT&T and Comcast and so on, they want the FCC to adopt what they call a light touch approach, basically to butt its head out. And some of their allies in Congress, particularly congressional Republicans, but also a number of Democrats, back them. They say it's not appropriate for the FCC to do any sort of regulation of the internet. And on the other side, you have these companies like Netflix and Google and so on that want access to their customers without having to pay more for it. And then you have consumer activists and so on who are generally more on the left side of the spectrum, although that's not always the case, who say we have to have an open internet, and the only way to get that is by the FCC stepping in and preventing the so-called fast lanes from taking off in the first place.
So as a consumer, I guess the fear is that, you know, Netflix gets charged more and they pass along that extra money to the consumer and then prices go up, you know, from people's pocketbooks who are paying at home. How likely is that scenario to unfold, do you think?
We don't know. We're 120 days off from, you know, even having something like an official position from the FCC. And then we are years off from knowing the future. And that's one of the tricky, really tricky things talking about net neutrality. The FCC is trying to create these regulations or not create regulations, even as the industry is evolving before our eyes. So they're really trying to hit a moving target.
Well, let's talk net neutrality as a broader concept for a moment. So as I understand it, the principle of net neutrality states that internet service providers and governments should treat all data on the internet equally, should not discriminate or charge differentially by user, by content, by site, platform, application. So based on what we know about these proposals, does this violate the basic tenet of net neutrality on which the internet is founded?
That's where things get really controversial, because the FCC chairman, Tom Wheeler, you know, the FCC favors a different phrase, open internet. But he basically says, oh, yeah, my plan is net neutrality, and we can create fast lanes maybe without also creating slow lanes. Some of the advocates who are criticizing the tack the agency is taking say that's nonsense. You can't create a fast lane without shunting some other people off to the side to this slow lane. And a big debate is, you know, over whether the broadband providers can ever charge anybody for quick access to their customers. Tom Wheeler thinks that maybe they can do that and we can still have an open internet. Some consumer advocates very strongly disagree.
So speaking of Tom Wheeler, the FCC chairman, he's promising a series of safeguards to make sure that these new proposed paid prioritization or fast lane practices are carried out fairly, that they won't harm consumers. Is this something that the FCC can really deliver on?
That's a big question. We've had 10 years of debates at the commission and in the courts over whether and how the FCC can enforce and back net neutrality. And there was a big court decision back in January that struck down the legal basis for the FCC's previous version of net neutrality. Now Wheeler is giving it another go. Under kind of a variation on the same legal footing. But the advocates are really upset because they want him to kind of go nuclear on the broadband companies, to reclassify them under a provision of the law, and basically treat them like public utilities, like water companies or electricity companies, which would arguably give the FCC a much stronger legal footing to regulate the industry. Of course, industry doesn't like that at all. They say that it would give the FCC far too much power in regulating the internet.
Matt, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Matt Sledge, Huffington Post reporter. Frank Lloyd Wright's S.C. Johnson Research Tower in Racine just opened to the public. Experts call the tower an architectural marvel. The lighting is remarkable, and its one exit is a 29-inch-wide twisting staircase.
We'll find out what else you can expect to find there from Sean Malone, the CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, and Greg Anderegg, Manager of Creative Operations and Corporate Archives at S.C. Johnson Company. Sean, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
And Greg, a pleasure to have you along, too.
Well, I'm glad to be here. Thanks very much.
Greg, could you describe the tower for people who haven't seen it? I understand you're sitting in it right now. What is it like?
Well, the research tower was opened on this campus in 1950, and it was designed as a facility to bring all of research and development together for SC Johnson. It's a 15-story tower that reaches about 150 feet in the air, and again, was a place where all of our research and development came together.
And Sean, in the context of the works of Frank Lloyd Wright, why is this tower important?
It's really an extraordinary space. I mean, it's, you know, for architects and architectural historians, this is one of the great iconic buildings of the 20th century. And one of the reasons that I think it's so important is that it's never been accessible before. You know, this was a working research tower, but it's never been something that the public could get into to see. And there aren't a lot of international architectural icons that come available to the public for the very first time ever. And it's one of the reasons that I personally was so excited when they made the announcement. And boy, did it live up to my expectations and surpass them, which was impressive because my expectations were pretty high.
Well, Greg, as we might expect, this is not your average building. It has some extraordinary features. I wonder if you could take us through some of the most striking.
Well, I think the thing that that is most remarkable about this building is that it's one of the tallest cantilevered buildings ever built in the U.S. So, again, it's got 15 floors, but the building is about 40-foot square. But in the center, there is a 13-foot in diameter core that reaches about 55 feet deep in the ground, rises to a height of 153 feet in the air, and all of the floors are hung off that central core, much the same way that tree limbs hang off the trunk of a tree. So the exterior walls of this building aren't load-bearing, it allowed for some very innovative architectural features from Mr. Wright in the design of the building.
And the windows themselves are unusual, right? Or at least the way that light enters the building. Maybe windows isn't the right word.
There are bands of glass tubing that surround the perimeter of the building. And in fact, there's 17 miles of Pyrex glass tubing in this building. So they're not windows in the conventional sense. They allow a tremendous amount of light to come into the floors, but they keep the focus of the people working in the building inside and on the work that's at hand.
And Sean, are these things that that Greg just described, do we see those in other Frank Lloyd Wright buildings, or are these, like a lot of Wright's work, uniquely unique?
I think uniquely unique is a great way to describe the research tower. I mean, certainly it plays its role in the continuum of Wright's work, and you can see similarities between the tower he created for S.C. Johnson and towers that he both created and designed throughout his life. In fact, right now there's a wonderful exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art that's part of a joint stewardship of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation archive that is really focusing on Wright in the city and has a number of towers both realized and conceived of that use a number of the structural effects that Greg was just talking about. That said, the research tower is one of a kind. You can't find anything else like it in the world, and it's just really an extraordinary experience.
And I have to say that it served the company as a tremendous center of innovation and creativity from the day that the building opened. For example, in the first 8 years that this research and development facility was open, iconic brands, global brands for this company that are known to consumers around the world came out of that tower. So things like Pledge, Raid, Off, Glade. So it was a period of tremendous creativity by the R&D team here at S.C. Johnson that this company and, frankly, consumers around the world continue to benefit from 60 years later.
So you have some huge names coming out of the building. What was it like to work there? Have you talked to the people who actually spent some time there?
You know, I'm kind of an old-timer here at S.C. Johnson, so the tower was still being used as a research and development facility when I first joined the company. And researchers that I talked to at that point in time told me that there was something special about this building, that the way that people were able to communicate with each other, interact with each other, work with each other, and then to be in such a creative design space itself, that it brought great energy and great pride to the team that worked here.
How has the building changed, Greg, over the years?
Well, it hasn't changed very much, to be honest with you. The basic architectural design features and structure of the building is exactly as it was in 1950. Of course, over the 32 years that the building was used for research and development, so that was 1950 to 1982, there might have been minor variations that were made in how some of the labs on each of the floors were set up. But structurally, very much what it was when it opened in 1950.
Now, I understand that the people who worked there at one point asked for sunglasses. Is that true?
Well, it is true. Now, there are 17 miles of glass tubing in the building, and as I said, it allows a tremendous amount of light in, and on particularly sunny days, it allowed a great deal of light in. So researchers would sometimes bring their sunglasses with them or would turn to the company and say, "Wait, can you provide us with some sunglasses to help facilitate our work?" Something that we were happy to do as a company. We're having actually some fun with that in our exhibition. The floors that visitors will be able to see, we've left just for fun a few sunglasses laying around on the countertops to remind us of that. So,
and Sean, Greg a minute ago was talking about how the people who worked in the building were inspired in their creativity by working in this creative space. Is that something that Frank Lloyd Wright might have thought of, trying to make the building inspire the function it was going to be used for?
Oh, there's no question. I mean, central to everything that Wright created was this sense of integrity. You know, when he talked about organic architecture, it wasn't just about a relationship with the landscape. It was about something being appropriate to place, but also to its time and to its function. And so if something is a research tower, he was creating something to inspire, to create a productive and imaginative space. And as you go through the space, it's very clear both how intentional the design was and also how successful the design was. It feels as if it is nurturing creativity and focus and exploration and experimentation. There is a visceral experience to the research tower like there is all of Wright's work. And it's a powerful experience.
Sean, are there any stories out there about what the process of planning this building was like for Frank Lloyd Wright?
There was certainly tons of correspondence between H.F. Johnson and Frank Lloyd Wright. I mean, they had worked together closely for, really decades and had a multifaceted relationship in terms of building of the primary administration building and this research tower and H.F. Johnson's home. And so it's probably one of the best documented creations of Wright and relationships with a client.
And Greg, Sean just mentioned that administration building. How do those buildings compare and contrast? How do they kind of fit together?
Oh, yeah, I think that's a wonderful question. So the administration building, which opened here in 1939, is one of the 25 most important buildings of the 21st century in the U.S., and it's a remarkable place called the Great Workroom. But Wright often referred to it as the corporate cathedral. He said, he wanted to create a space that was as meaningful a place to work in as any cathedral ever was to worship in. If you think about that in that context, then the research tower is actually the completion of the great work of art. It is, in fact, sort of the bell tower to the corporate cathedral. And so we very much, while they are two commissions, two separate buildings, here we often think of them, frankly, as one remarkable architectural work of art.
So it sounds like an incredible opportunity for the public to get to experience this. Why has it been open to the public now, Greg?
Well, we've just completed a 4.5-year restoration of all of the Frank Lloyd Wright buildings on this campus, and it just felt right to make the building open now for the first time for visitors. And so we're delighted that starting on May 2nd of this year that we are open for the summer months in 2014, and frankly intend to do that annually for the years to come.
And, Sean, this must have been a kid in the candy store moment for you when you got to take a tour. What was it like getting through this building?
Well, it was fantastic. I've been to the administration building so many times, and I think like so many, I mean, first just as an enthusiast and then professionally, I've been with the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation for just over 2 years. And in both cases, after I did the tour and after I spent time in the administration building, there was this desire to complete it, to complete my experience, to go into, as Greg said, the bell tower, having been in the corporate cathedral. And so it was a real sense of completion to be able to finally experience what Wright had created to nurture the creativity of H.F. Johnson and his company.
Well, it sounds pretty extraordinary. Thank you both for coming on and talking about it. Sean, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And Greg, thank you as well.
Well, thank you for your time today.
That was Sean Malone, CEO of the Frank Lloyd Wright Foundation, and Greg Anderegg, Manager of Creative Operations and Corporate Archives at S.C. Johnson Company. They joined us to talk about the newly opened Frank Lloyd Wright S.C. Johnson Tower in Racine.
When the nation has seen mass shootings over the last few years, mental illness often enters the conversation, and improved mental health screening and treatment is offered as a possible solution.
Well, our next guest says we tend to overlook a key element in violence, and that's anger. She says we need to take anger seriously and makes the case that in our mental health system and even our daily lives, we can do a lot to deal with it better.
Laura Hayes is with us. She's a clinical psychologist in Bethesda, Maryland. A recent piece she wrote on anger is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So you say that when it comes to things like mass shootings, we don't talk about anger enough. Why should anger be a bigger part of the conversation?
Well, I think that the conversation has been diverted recently in the last few years, specifically to the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a bit of a red herring. The statistics actually support anger being and past history of violence as being predictors, strong predictors of homicides, whereas mentally ill people commit really a very small proportion of violent crimes. There are, I think, multiple reasons for this focus, but I think we're missing the real point here, which is that people that have a history of acting out violently, people who have a history with the law, have a much higher probability of ending up doing something really dramatic and heinous.
What do you think we're missing when, as a society, we focus in on mental illness and miss the anger part of it?
Well, I think that I think there's a misattribution going on here. I think actually we could remove mental health as a part of this overall, at least diagnosed mental illnesses. When we're talking about people who have things like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder, they have no greater probability of being involved in a violent crime than anyone else does. Anger, on the other hand, is a pretty pervasive issue. It's something that all of us have to deal with. It's biologically wired into us. And if it comes up inappropriately in, our technological, highly densely populated, industrialized society, it's inappropriate.
Laura, before we dig deeper into anger, if we misattribute violence to people with mental illness, does that add to a stigma of people with diagnosed mental illness, make people look at them as ticking time bombs when we shouldn't?
I think that's absolutely true, and in fact, that was what led me to write this story. I have a client who has some paranoia. She's diagnosed bipolar, and she has watched this happen in the news over and over again. Essentially, I think what's happening is conversation after these terrible mass murders used to turn frequently to gun control. And the NRA is handling this really deftly, I think, so then the focus has now shifted to the mentally ill. But in a way, that's not constructive. In a way, you know, where they're being called lunatics and crazies, a lot of really hostile things are being said about them. But, you know, in terms of doing something to manage gun control with mentally ill people, it's not something that the gun control people are interested in really putting energy behind. So we're setting them up. They're getting a lot of attention. And for my patient, it was really frightening. And this did feed into some paranoia. And we had a conversation about how this overall anger piece was really being overlooked as we're talking about whether it's about guns or whether it's about mental illness. It's about anger, whether you're mentally ill or not.
How do we know when anger is normal? Because we often hear that anger is healthy and it's good to let anger out and express it. How do we know when it's that kind of anger or when it's something that is something that could become violent?
Right. That's a great question. So anger is basically a normal, healthy response that's wired into us. we have to be able to protect ourselves. And our whole nervous system is designed to flip between a more passive, relaxed state, the parasympathetic nervous system, and an action-oriented fight-or-flight state, sympathetic nervous system. We're not going to get away from that for probably quite a while. I mean, that's an evolutionary piece of us. And it works really, really well when you're facing down a wolf pack. You have to take action immediately. You can't sit around and think about it. If you don't do something fast, you're going to be dead. But when you take that in to your office and your boss comes in and says, you know, I really don't think you're putting in the time you need to be putting in, and you go into fight or flight response, life or death, I need to kill or in order to survive, it's really inappropriate and dysfunctional. And most of us manage to monitor that enough so that we don't get into a whole lot of trouble. Some of us don't. Some of us have histories that haven't really taught us to do that stuff well, and we can behave in really inappropriate ways. So just very quickly, the easy case is if you have uncontrollable anger or chronic anger or irritability, if you just feel that rumbling all the time, or if when you get angry it feels really uncontrollable, or you feel like you need a drink or some drugs or something to manage it, or if you lose control of it, you become violent, you become threatening, or if other people are maybe hinting to you that perhaps you could need a little bit of help in this area. Those are pretty easy. And in fact, when someone has that problem, they usually already know it. They've already gotten in trouble and it's been drawn to their attention. But rage can also be precipitated by feelings that don't seem to be anger. For example, shame or loss or betrayal, which goes something like, my girlfriend cheated on me, so I broke all the windows in her car. You don't hear the anger in there. You can kind of think, you know, maybe we're skipping over a step there, but what you might see in this person is really the pain of being betrayed, and then the windows go out in the girlfriend's car. So it's not always that you're just looking for someone who demonstrates excessive anger. You may also see really deep sadness, crying or an inability to take action, or you may see numbness. So this is more, I mean, it's Mental Health Month, too, so it's kind of good to kick these out here. But you may see different kinds of symptoms. You may see relationships that if someone's relationships mostly are incredibly dramatic with crying and threats and physical fighting and maybe destruction of property, that's a red flag. There's something going on underneath it that's not being managed. Or troubling thoughts of violence or of hurting someone or hurting yourself. Those are all signs that it would be a good idea probably to go and talk to someone. And then, you know, one that I really think that gets neglected is this idea of being a loner, because loners are by definition withdrawn, not socially integrated, and they're quiet. I think we often underestimate the impact of being that person, being an outsider who doesn't have a place in society, who is maybe ostracized or has been, who's been bullied, who's been mocked, and is carrying a lot of feelings about that, but they're not being expressed.
You know, I think a lot of us might think of being anger prone or not just as part of our personality, not as something we can treat or do something about. Can we really have that much control over our anger?
That's an interesting question, because I believe that the main approach to anger, the most effective approach to anger, is actually acknowledge what the experience is, acknowledge what's going on internally. So we're actually not trying to take away anybody's feelings. We're trying to make it okay to sit with the feelings that you have. So you may, in fact, feel furious about something that's happened to you in a relationship or at work, but you have a lot of choices about what you actually do about it.
Now, when you use the terminology "sit with the anger," you're sort of using the language that we're starting to get used to hearing when we talk about meditation. And I wonder how you feel about that as a tool for working with anger.
Yes, that's no coincidence. I think that mindfulness is extremely useful for managing a multitude of things. That is really kind of the center of it, is to be okay, to be present, to allow your feelings to exist, to not try to censor them, to not try to hide from them, to not deny them, but but to just permit them to be there. I think mindfulness is a tremendously helpful tool and a really good starting point. It takes little effort to do. There are many resources where you can listen to meditation, kind of guided imagery to walk through it, so you don't even have to think about it. But it can really let you allow your feelings to become comfortable. Still, you will know, you know, I'm grieving because I lost my father. I feel really guilty about something that I did once in the past. Those feelings still are there, but they don't run you anymore.
We're talking to clinical psychologist Laura Hayes about anger, its role in leading to violence, and what we can do about it.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have ways of dealing with anger in your life? Do you meditate maybe to keep anger under control? And do you think anger is a major problem in our society, maybe one that gets overlooked, especially when we're looking at violent crime? Call at 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org. We're continuing our conversation now about anger with clinical psychologist Laura Hayes. She says we can improve our lives and our society by learning how to deal with anger.
And we want to hear from you. Do you think we have an anger problem in our society? Are we ignoring anger? Do you think it's a cause of problems, including violence? What do you do to manage anger in your life? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. Go right to our callers now. We've got Lynette on the line in Milwaukee. Lynette, hi.
Yeah, hi. I find the conversation interesting. I personally do meditate when I'm angry or feeling upset. I do practice mindfulness. But I did want to mention, I think there's a cultural component to the perception of anger. I know that I'm an African-American woman, and I know there's this, you know, stereotype of angry black woman. And an issue came up with my niece, something at her school, where school counselor accused her of being angry, and she wasn't. She was upset, and she and I talked about it later, and we were trying to figure out, you know, is it a tone of voice? You know, I think sometimes across cultures and also maybe genders, a perception of when someone is angry and when they're just upset is interpreted differently. I don't know. It seems like that to me.
Lynette, thank you. That's very interesting. Laura, talking about the way we read each other's anger can be confusing within a cultural group, too, I think, but maybe more so between groups.
That's a really, really good point. It sounds to me like there's a judgment being made about the anger as well, and I think there are differences in how we label it, but there are cultural differences in how much you're allowed to express, how vehemently you're allowed to express something. And there are also gender differences in how much is permitted there and when it's considered to be. I think there's a huge difference in how much expression is permitted to boys and how much is permitted to girls within what we consider to be a healthy range.
So what if you feel you're being misunderstood when it comes to expressing your anger, maybe in a scenario like Lynette just described, or maybe a girl in a classroom? What is a way to confront, you know, the safety or, you know, the viability of expressing anger in a place like that?
Are you talking about specifically with an authority figure like her counselor?
Yeah, probably.
Yeah, how old is her daughter?
I'm not sure. She's off the line now, but, you know, let's say a grade school kid, maybe.
Yeah. So I think what we want to do is we want to, well, this goes two directions. One is we want to be able to say to our kids, you need to be able to assert yourself. And actually, you know, one of the things that I think is really important in dealing with anger, in addition to mindfulness and a number of other things, is assertiveness training. Because a lot of anger comes out of feeling like you're vulnerable. I mean, these things, the betrayal or feeling like you're being treated unfairly, many things that we react to with rage are really about our own fear or vulnerability. So to strengthen that, to feel like we can be assertive and we can speak directly without insulting people or being inappropriate, that's a really powerful tool and actually an important part of sort of rehabilitative anger management. So, I mean, for a child, that's really important that you teach them from the beginning, you know, you can say no, that's really not what's happening. I'm really feeling this. Stand up for yourself. You know, when you're being misunderstood, you don't need to get angry about it. You just need to tell them, and if they don't get it, they don't get it. Sometimes that's true, even if it's an adult, even if it's your teacher. But stick up for yourself. Stand by what you believe. I also believe that the mindfulness tools, the assertiveness tools, the relaxation tools, some of the cognitive process tools, all of this stuff is really pretty simple. And it's stuff that we could easily include in our curriculum. I mean, this could be a very important part of health curriculum for kids. It could be, I know a teacher who starts her class every day by having the kids close their eyes and do deep breaths, do three deep breaths before they start. And you walk into her classroom and it's like, the kids are all on benzodiazepines. I mean, it's just the relaxation is palpable when you walk in the room. So the schools should be included in this as well.
Lynette, thanks a lot for bringing up those issues. We'll go now to Josh with us in Appleton. Josh, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how's it going? That was actually part of my question, as I was going to talk about social heredity as far as a child's upbringing and dealing with anger, I think, is one of the biggest issues in our society today. And I don't think that kids are being taught, or for that matter, adults or just people in general are being taught to replace their anger with understanding. I think if you replace your anger with understanding and trying to actually figure out what it is with the situation, instead of getting angry, if you don't take something personally.
All right, Josh, I want to get Laura in on this. Are there good ways for parents to teach or maybe model good anger management for their kids?
Oh,
Laura,
absolutely. Absolutely. I think that is really important. And I think, you know, there's a semantic issue here, but when you talk about replacing your anger with something else, I think for some people that can be very difficult. I mean, you're losing something that's an important part of you. That anger is actually pretty big. And I like the idea better that you accept the anger and be okay with that, and then move. There is a cognitive technique that's moving from your emotional mind, which is saying, I'm really upset right now, this is really making me angry, to your wise mind, which says, you know, yeah, it's making you angry. I see that, and sort of observes it and says, okay, now what's the most effective thing that I can do right now? And that kind of thing you can teach that to your kids too. You can model it. It's like, okay, I came in and I was yelling because the neighbor, you know, cut me off, and I'm sorry for yelling at everybody, and I need to move from my emotional mind into my wise mind and show the kids you're actually living it. More than teaching it, you're living it and putting words on it, putting labels on it.
Well, thank you so much for that call. And let's go next to Joan in Williams Bay. Hey, Joan.
Hi. It's good topic.
Thank you.
I think we should talk about it often. I think people get angry when they lose sight of the choices that are available to them. If they are driving, they have to be aware that they have choices. If there's a driver that makes them angry, they have to tell themselves that they have a choice to make. Like, I'll turn the radio on, or I'll think about something else. You know, you've always got choices unless you're really in a dire situation.
All right. Yeah, good points, Jonah, about choosing between different responses when we get angry. Is that something that we can train ourselves to do?
Yes, definitely. I think that's a great example of being in a fight or flight mode and wanting, you know, what you want to do is you want to ram the car next to you. But what you do instead is you think to yourself, you know, I'll just listen to music. It doesn't really matter. That person doesn't matter to me. Or maybe that person has, you know, a dire emergency that they need to get to, and I don't really know what's in their head. and I can let it go. Or, you know, any of a number of other things. Language is actually really helpful in this. I think talking yourself through. In a car, this works really well because you can talk out loud and you don't look like you're talking, although now with the cell phones, you can pretty much do that anyway. But talk to yourself. Talk yourself through it and say, you know, what are my choices here? Can I do something besides make myself feel worse? Can I move to a wise mind where I'm going to feel better?
Laura, you're hoping that we as a society take anger more seriously. On the mental health profession side, where does that start? How can the profession start thinking about anger?
Yeah, we're slackers on this. I completely concede that. I think that I have so much stuff that I would like to share that I know there isn't time to even talk about here. There's so many different simple techniques and skills that can be used. And what's happened in my opinion, in the opinion of many others, is that the mental health industry has kind of been co-opted by the pharmaceutical companies who, to a great extent, dictate how our diagnostic manual, the DSM, is written. And originally, back in the 50s, it was written from the perspective that there were underlying causes to mental health problems. And in the 80s, that all kind of disappeared. And there are just clusters of symptoms to which you assign particular drugs. You're bipolar, you take lithium. And it's taken us away from this more organic thinking about subtleties and nuances. You know, I can say, you know, my dad was a little bit paranoid. My mom was a little bit of a hypochondriac, and maybe not diagnosable, but an individual person with different aspects. And we're not really doing that. We're dealing in terms of medications and diagnoses for which the medications can be prescribed, and we're missing this whole other world of what's going on inside of people. So there is, I think, a trend to incorporate mindfulness. That's, you know, started to move into the culture in general and a little bit into therapy. And I think it makes us a little bit more open to, Eastern approaches to health, which is more holistic.
We'll leave it there for now. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was clinical psychologist Laura Hayes. Her recent piece on anger and violence is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.